Chapter 3. Our Constitution. There's a saying that senators frequently use when asked to describe their first year on Capitol Hill. It's like drinking from a fire hose. The description is apt, for during my first few months in the Senate, everything seemed to be coming at me at once. I had to hire staff and set up offices in Washington and Illinois. I had to negotiate committee assignments and get up to speed on the issues pending before the committees. There was the backlog of 10,000 constituent letters that had accumulated since Election Day, and the 300 speaking invitations that were arriving every week. In half-hour blocks, I was shuttled from the Senate floor to committee rooms, to hotel lobbies, to radio stations, entirely dependent on an assortment of recently hired staffers in their 20s and 30s to keep me on schedule, hand me the right briefing book, remind me who I was meeting with, or steer me to the nearest restroom. Then, at night, there was the adjustment of living alone. Michelle and I had decided to keep the family in Chicago, in part because we liked the idea of raising the girls outside the hothouse environment of Washington, but also because the arrangement gave Michelle a circle of support from her mother, brother, other family and friends that could help her manage the prolonged absences my job would require. So for the 3 nights a week that I spent in Washington, I rented a small one-bedroom apartment near Georgetown Law School, in a high-rise between Capitol Hill and downtown. At first, I tried to embrace my newfound solitude, forcing myself to remember the pleasures of bachelorhood, gathering takeout menus from every restaurant in the neighborhood, watching basketball or reading late into the night, hitting the gym for a midnight workout, leaving dishes in the sink, and not making my bed. But it was no use. After 13 years of marriage, I found myself to be fully domesticated, soft, and helpless. My first morning in Washington, I realized I'd forgotten to buy a shower curtain and had to scrunch up against the shower wall in order to avoid flooding the bathroom floor. The next night, watching the game and having a beer, I fell asleep at halftime and woke up on the couch 2 hours later with a bad crick in my neck. Takeout food didn't taste so good anymore. The silence irked me. I found myself calling home repeatedly, just to listen to my daughter's voices, aching for the warmth of their hugs and the sweet smell of their skin. There were a handful of senators who also had young families, and whenever we met, we would compare notes on the pros and cons of moving to Washington, as well as the difficulty in protecting family time from overzealous staff. But most of my new colleagues were considerably older. The average age was 60. And so, as I made the rounds to their offices, their advice usually related to the business of the Senate. They explained to me the advantages of various committee assignments and the temperaments of various committee chairmen. They offered suggestions on how to organize staff, who to talk to for extra office space, and how to manage constituent requests. Most of the advice I found useful. Occasionally, it was contradictory. But among Democrats, at least, my meetings would end with one consistent recommendation. As soon as possible, they said, I should schedule a meeting with Senator Byrd, not only as a matter of senatorial courtesy, but because Senator Byrd's senior position on the Appropriations Committee and general stature in the Senate still gave him considerable clout. At 87 years old, Senator Robert C. Byrd was not simply the Dean of the Senate. He had come to be seen as the very embodiment of the Senate. I'd already left a message with Senator Byrd's office requesting a meeting when I first had an opportunity to see him in person. It was the day of our swearing-in, and we had been in the old Senate chamber, a dark, ornate place dominated by a large gargoyle-like eagle that stretched out over the presiding officer's chair from an awning of dark blood-red velvet. The somber setting matched the occasion, as the Democratic caucus was meeting to organize itself after the difficult election and the loss of its leader. After the new leadership team was installed, Minority Leader Reid asked Senator Byrd if he would say a few words. Slowly, the senior senator rose from his seat, a slender man, with a still thick snowy mane, watery blue eyes, and sharp, prominent nose. For a moment he stood in silence, steadying himself with his cane, his head turned upward, eyes fixed on the ceiling. Then he began to speak, in somber, measured tones, a hint of the Appalachians, like a knotty grain of wood beneath polished veneer. I don't recall the specifics of his speech, but I remember the broad themes cascading out from the well of the old chamber in a rising Shakespearean rhythm. The clockwork design of the Constitution and the Senate as the essence of that charter's promise. The dangerous encroachment, year after year, of the executive branch on the Senate's precious independence. The need for every senator to reread our founding documents so that we might remain steadfast and faithful and true to the meaning of the Republic. As he spoke, his voice grew more forceful. His forefinger stabbed the air. The dark room seemed to close in on him, until he seemed almost a specter, the spirit of Senate's past, his almost 50 years in these chambers reaching back to touch the previous 50 years, and the 50 years before that, and the 50 years before that, back to a time when Jefferson, Adams, Madison, and Hamilton still roamed Congress's halls, and the city itself was still wilderness and farmland and swamp. Back to a time when neither I nor those who looked like me could have sat within these walls. Sitting there listening to the old man speak, I felt with full force all the essential contradictions of me in this new place, with its marble busts, its arcane traditions, its memories, and its ghosts. I pondered the fact that according to his own autobiography, Senator Byrd had received his first taste of leadership in his early 20s. As a member of the Raleigh County Ku Klux Klan, an association that he had long disavowed, an error he attributed, no doubt correctly, to the time and place in which he had been raised, but which continued to surface as an issue throughout his career. I thought about how he had joined other giants of the Senate, like William J. Fulbright of Arkansas and Richard Russell of Georgia, in Southern resistance to civil rights legislation. I wondered if this would matter to the liberals who now lionized Senator Byrd for his principled opposition to the Iraq War resolution, the MoveOn.org crowd, the heirs of the political counterculture the senator had spent much of his career disdaining. I wondered if it should matter. Senator Byrd's life, like most of ours, has been the struggle of warring impulses, a twining of darkness and light. And in that sense, I realized that he really was a proper emblem for the Senate, whose rules and design reflect the grand compromise of America's founding, the bargain between northern states and southern states, the Senate's role as a guardian against the passions of the moment, a defender of minority rights and state sovereignty, but also a tool to protect the wealthy from the rabble, and assure slaveholders non-interference with their peculiar institution. Stamped into the very fiber of the Senate, within its genetic code, was the same contest between power and principle that characterized America as a whole, a lasting expression of that great debate between a few brilliant, flawed men that had concluded with the creation of a form of government unique in its genius, yet blind to the whip and the chain. The speech ended. Fellow senators clapped and congratulated Senator Byrd for his magnificent oratory. I went over to introduce myself, and he grasped my hand warmly, saying how much he looked forward to sitting down for a visit. Walking back to my office, I decided I would unpack my old constitutional law books that night and reread the document itself. For Senator Byrd was right. To understand what was happening in Washington in 2005, to understand my new job, and to understand Senator Byrd, one needed to circle back to the start, to America's earliest debates and founding documents, to trace how they had played out over time, and make judgments in light of subsequent history. If you ask my 8-year-old what I do for a living, she might say I make laws. And yet, one of the surprising things about Washington is the amount of time spent arguing not about what the law should be, but rather what the law is. The simplest statute, a requirement, say, that companies provide bathroom breaks to their hourly workers, becomes the subject of wildly different interpretations, depending on who you're talking to, the congressman who sponsored the provision, the staffer who drafted it, the department head whose job it is to enforce it, the lawyer whose client finds it inconvenient, or the judge who may be called upon to apply it. Some of this is by design, a result of the complex machinery of checks and balances. The diffusion of power between the branches, as well as between federal and state governments, means that no law is ever final, no battle truly finished. There's always the opportunity to strengthen or weaken what appears to be done, to water down a regulation or block its implementation, to contract an agency's power with a cut in their budget, or to seize control of an issue where a vacuum has been left. Partly it's the nature of the law itself. For in the end, all laws are just words on a page. Words that are often malleable, opaque, as dependent on context and trust and empathy as they are in a story or poem or promise to someone. Words whose meaning are subject to constant erosion. When it came to questions of national security, in the post-9/11 era, for example, the White House stood fast against any suggestion that it was answerable to Congress or the courts. During the hearings to confirm Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, arguments flared over everything from the scope of Congress's resolution authorizing the war in Iraq to the willingness of executive branch members to testify under oath. During the debate surrounding the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez, I would review memos produced by the Attorney General's office that suggested the word torture might not encompass techniques like sleep deprivation or repeated suffocation that failed to induce, quote, severe pain, or transcripts that suggested the Geneva Convention did not apply to enemy combatants captured in a war in Afghanistan, opinions that the Fourth Amendment did not apply to U.S. citizens labeled enemy combatants and captured on U.S. soil. None of these issues are easy. Many are worthy of serious debate. Even more than the substantive policies that the White House and its congressional allies were pursuing, though, what troubled me was the process, or lack of process, by which they disposed of opposing views, the sense that the rules of governing no longer applied, and that there were no fixed meanings or standards to which we could appeal. It was as if those in power had decided that habeas corpus, or separation of powers, were niceties that only got in the way, that they complicated what was obvious, like the need to stop terrorists, or impeded what was right, and could therefore be disregarded, or at least bent to strong wills. The irony, of course, was that such disregard of the rules and the manipulation of language to achieve a particular outcome was precisely what conservatives had long accused liberals of doing. It was one of the rationales behind Newt Gingrich's contract with America, the notion that the Democratic barons who then controlled the House of Representatives consistently abused the legislative process for their own gain. It was the basis for the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, the scorn heaped on the sad phrase, "It depends on what the meaning of is is." It was the basis of conservative broadsides against liberal academics, those high priests of political correctness, it was argued, who refused to acknowledge any eternal truths or hierarchies of knowledge and indoctrinated America's youth with dangerous moral relativism. And it was at the very heart of the conservative assault on the federal courts. Gaining control of the courts generally, and the Supreme Court in particular, had become the holy grail for a generation of conservative activists. And not just, they insisted, because they viewed the court as the last bastion of pro-abortion, pro-affirmative action, pro-homosexual, pro-criminal, pro-regulation, anti-religious liberal elitism. According to these activists, liberal judges had placed themselves above the law, basing their opinions not on the Constitution, but on their own whims and desired results, finding rights to abortion or sodomy that did not exist in the Constitution, subverting the democratic process, and perverting the Founding Fathers' original intent. To return the courts to their proper role required the appointment of strict constructionists to the federal bench, men and women who understood the difference between interpreting and making laws. Those on the left saw the situation quite differently. With conservative Republicans making gains in the congressional and presidential elections, many liberals viewed the courts as the only thing standing in the way of a radical effort to roll back civil rights, women's rights, civil liberties, environmental regulation, church and state separation, and the entire legacy of the New Deal. During the Bork nomination, advocacy groups and Democratic leaders organized their opposition with a sophistication that had never been seen for a judicial confirmation. When the nomination was defeated, conservatives realized that they would have to build their own grassroots army. Since then, each side had claimed incremental advances and setbacks. Democrats complained loudly when Republicans used control of the Judiciary Committee to block 61 of Clinton's appointments to appellate and district courts. And for the brief time that they held the majority, the Democrats tried the same tactic on George W. Bush's nominees. But when the Democrats lost their Senate majority in 2002, they had only one arrow left in their quiver, a strategy that could be summed up in one word, the battle cry around which the Democratic faithful now rallied. Filibuster. The Constitution makes no mention of the filibuster. It is a Senate rule, one that dates back to the very first Congress. The basic idea is simple. Because all Senate business is conducted by unanimous consent, any senator can bring proceedings to a halt by exercising his right to unlimited debate and refusing to move on to the next order of business. In other words, he can talk for as long as he wants. So long as he or like-minded colleagues are willing to stay on the floor and talk, everything else has to wait, which gives each senator an enormous amount of leverage and a determined minority effective veto power over any piece of legislation. Throughout the Senate's modern history, the filibuster has remained a preciously guarded prerogative. One of the distinguishing features, it is said, along with six-year terms and the allocation of two senators to each state, regardless of population, that separates the Senate from the House and serves as a firewall against the dangers of majority overreach. There's another, grimmer history to the filibuster, though, one that carries special relevance for me. For almost a century, the filibuster was the South's weapon of choice in its efforts to protect Jim Crow from federal interference, the legal blockade that effectively gutted the 14th and 15th Amendments. Decade after decade, courtly, erudite men like Senator Richard B. Russell of Georgia used the filibuster to choke off any and every piece of civil rights legislation before the Senate, whether voting rights bills, or fair employment bills, or anti-lynching bills. With words, with rules, with procedures and precedent, with law, Southern senators had succeeded in perpetuating black subjugation in ways that mere violence never could. The filibuster hadn't just stopped bills. For many blacks in the South, the filibuster had snuffed out hope. Democrats used the filibuster sparingly in George Bush's first term. Of the president's 200-plus judicial nominees, only 10 were prevented from getting to the floor for an up or down vote. Still, all 10 were nominees to appellate courts, the courts that counted. All 10 were standard bearers for the conservative cause. And if Democrats maintained their filibuster on these 10 fine jurists, conservatives argued, there would be nothing to prevent them from having their way with future Supreme Court nominees. So it came to pass that President Bush, emboldened by a bigger Republican majority in the Senate and his self-proclaimed mandate, decided in the first few weeks of his second term to renominate 7 previously filibustered judges. As a poke in the eye to the Democrats, it produced the desired response. Democratic leader Harry Reid called it a big wet kiss to the far right and renewed the threat of a filibuster. Republicans, sensing that this was the time to go in for the kill, announced that if Democrats continued in their obstructionist ways, they would have no choice but to invoke the dreaded nuclear option, a novel procedural maneuver that would involve the Senate's presiding officer, perhaps Vice President Cheney himself, ignoring the opinion of the Senate parliamentarian, breaking 200 years of Senate precedent, and deciding with a simple bang of the gavel that the use of filibusters was no longer permissible under the Senate rules, at least when it came to judicial nominations. To me, the threat to eliminate the filibuster on judicial nominations was just one more example of Republicans changing the rules in the middle of the game. Moreover, a good argument could be made that a vote on judicial nominations is precisely the situation where the filibuster's supermajority requirement makes sense. Because federal judges receive lifetime appointments and often serve through the terms of multiple presidents, it behooves a president and benefits our democracy to find moderate nominees who can garner some measure of bipartisan support. Few of the Bush nominees in question fell into the moderate category. Rather, they showed a pattern of hostility towards civil rights, privacy, and checks on executive power that put them to the right of even most Republican judges. One particularly troubling nominee had derisively called Social Security and other New Deal programs, quote, the triumph of our own socialist revolution, unquote. Still, I remember muffling a laugh the first time I heard the term nuclear option. It seemed to perfectly capture the loss of perspective that had come to characterize judicial confirmations, part of the spin fest that permitted groups on the left to run ads featuring scenes of Jimmy Stewart's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, without any mention that segregationists Strom Thurmond and Jim Eastland had played Mr. Smith in real life. The shameless mythologizing that allowed Southern Republicans to rise on the Senate floor and somberly in tone about the improprieties of filibusters, without even a peep of acknowledgement that it was the politicians from their states, their direct political forebears, that had perfected the art for a malicious cause. Not many of my fellow Democrats appreciated the irony. As the judicial confirmation process began heating up, I had a conversation with a friend in which I admitted concern with some of the strategies we were using to discredit and block appointees. I had no doubt of the damage that some of Bush's judicial nominees might do. I would support the filibuster of certain of these judges, if nothing else than to signal to the White House the need to moderate its next selections. But elections ultimately meant something, I said. Instead of relying on Senate procedures, there was one way to ensure that judges on the bench reflected our values, and that was to win at the polls. Do you really think that if the situation were reversed, Republicans would have any qualms about using the filibuster? My friend asked me. I didn't, and yet I doubted that our use of the filibuster would dispel the image of Democrats always being on the defensive, a perception that we used the courts and lawyers and procedural tricks to avoid having to win over popular opinion. In our reliance on the courts to vindicate not only our rights but also our values, I wondered if progressives had lost too much faith in democracy. Just as conservatives appear to have lost any sense that democracy must be more than what the majority insists upon. For 10 years before coming to Washington, I taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago. I loved the law school classroom, the stripped-down nature of it, the high-wire act of standing in front of a room at the beginning of each class with just blackboard and chalk, the students taking measure of me, some intent or apprehensive, others demonstrative in their boredom, the tension broken by my first question, "What's this case about?" and the hands tentatively rising, the initial responses and me pushing back against whatever arguments surfaced, until slowly the bare words were peeled back and what had appeared dry and lifeless just a few minutes ago suddenly came alive, and my students' eyes stirred, the text becoming for them a part not just of the past, but of their present and their future. A careful reading of the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, and the Constitution reminds us just how much all our attitudes have been shaped by them. Take the idea of inalienable rights. More than 200 years after the Declaration of Independence was written and the Bill of Rights was ratified, we continue to argue about the meaning of reasonable search, or whether the Second Amendment prohibits all gun regulation, or whether the desecration of the flag should be considered speech. We debate whether such basic common law rights as the right to marry, or the right to maintain our bodily integrity, are implicitly, if not explicitly, recognized by the Constitution, and whether these rights encompass personal decisions involving abortion, or end-of-life care, or homosexual partnerships. And yet, for all our disagreements, we would be hard-pressed to find a conservative or liberal in America today, whether Republican or Democrat, academic or layman, who doesn't subscribe to the basic set of individual liberties identified by the founders and enshrined in our Constitution and our common law. The right to speak our minds, the right to worship how and if we wish, the right to peaceably assemble to petition our government, the right to own, buy, and sell property, and not have it taken away without fair compensation, the right not to be searched or detained by the state without due process, the right to a fair and speedy trial, and the right to make our own determinations with minimal restriction regarding family life and the way we raise our children. We consider these rights to be universal, a codification of liberty's meaning, constraining all levels of government and applicable to all people within the boundaries of our political community. Moreover, we recognize that the very idea of these universal rights presupposes the equal worth of every individual. In that sense, wherever we lie on the political spectrum, we all subscribe to the founders' teachings. We also recognize that a declaration is not a government. A creed is not enough. The founders recognized that there were seeds of anarchy in the idea of individual freedom, an intoxicating danger in the idea of equality. For if everybody is truly free, without the constraints of birth or rank or an inherited social order, then how can we ever hope to form a society that coheres? The solution that the founders arrived at, after contentious debate and multiple drafts, proved to be their novel contribution to the world. The outlines of Madison's constitutional architecture are so familiar that even schoolchildren can recite them. Not only rule of law and representative government, not just a Bill of Rights, but also the separation of the national government into three coequal branches, a bicameral Congress, and a conception of federalism that preserved authority in state governments, all of it designed to diffuse power, check faction, balance interests, and prevent tyranny by either the few or the many. As with our understanding of the Declaration, we debate the details of constitutional construction. We may object to Congress's abuse of expanded Commerce Clause powers to the detriment of the states, or the erosion of Congress's power to declare war. But we are confident in the fundamental soundness of the Founders' blueprints and the Democratic House that resulted. Conservative or liberal, we are all constitutionalists. So if we all believe in individual liberty, and we all believe in these rules of democracy, what is our modern argument about? If we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that much of the time we are arguing about results, the actual decisions that the courts and the legislature make about the profound and difficult issues that help shape our lives. Should we let teachers lead our children in prayer and leave open the possibility that the minority faiths of some children are diminished? Or do we forbid such prayer and force parents of faith to hand over their children to a secular world 8 hours a day? Is a university being fair by taking the history of racial discrimination and exclusion into account when filling a limited number of slots in its medical school? Or does fairness demand that universities treat every applicant in a colorblind fashion? More often than not, if a particular procedural rule, the right to filibuster, say, or a Supreme Court's approach to constitutional interpretation, helps us win the argument and upholds our position, then for that moment at least, we think it's a pretty good rule. If it doesn't help us win, then we tend not to like it so much. Of course, there's more at stake in our current debates about the Constitution and the proper role of the courts. We are also arguing about how to argue, the means, in a big, crowded, noisy democracy, of settling our disputes peacefully. We want to win, but most of us also recognize the need for consistency, predictability, and coherence. We want the rules to be fair. And so, when we get in a tussle about abortion or flag burning, we appeal to a higher authority, the Founding Fathers, to give us more direction. Some, like Justice Scalia, conclude that the Founding Fathers will tell us all that we need to know, and that if we strictly obey the rules they've laid out, for example, that the only rights protected in the Constitution are those that are written out in plain English, as understood by those who wrote them, then democracy is respected and fairness is achieved. Others, like Justice Breyer, don't dispute that the plain meaning of constitutional provisions matter, but they insist that sometimes the text can only take you so far, that on the truly hard cases, the truly big arguments, we have to take context, history, and the practical outcomes of a decision into account. According to this view, the Founding Fathers have told us how to think, but are no longer around to tell us what to think. We are on our own, and we have only reason and our judgment to rely on. Anyone like Justice Scalia, looking to resolve our modern constitutional dispute through strict construction, has one big problem. The Founders themselves disagreed profoundly, vehemently, on the meaning of their masterpiece. Before the ink on the constitutional parchment was dry, arguments had erupted, not just about minor provisions, but about first principles. Not just between peripheral figures, but within the Revolution's very core. They argued about how much power the national government should have to supersede state laws, to form a standing army, or to assume debt. They argued about the president's role in establishing treaties with foreign powers, and about the Supreme Court's role in determining the law. They argued about the meaning of such basic rights as freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And on several occasions, when the fragile state seemed threatened, they were not averse to ignoring those rights altogether. So if the Founders themselves didn't agree, if strict construction will not work, then how do we determine what the Constitution should mean? The answer I settle on, which is by no means original to me, requires a shift in metaphors, one that sees our democracy not as a house to be built, but a conversation to be had. According to this conception, the genius of Madison's design is not that it provides us a fixed blueprint for action, the way a draftsman plots a building's construction. It provides us with rules, a framework. But fidelity to these rules will not guarantee a just society or assure agreement on what's right. What the rules and framework of our Constitution can do is organize the way by which we argue about our future. They force us into a conversation, a deliberative democracy, in which each and every citizen is required to engage in a process of testing his or her ideas against an external reality, persuading others to their point of view, and building shifting alliances of consent. The process requires us to persuade and not coerce. It forces us to entertain the possibility that we are not always right and to sometimes change our minds. It challenges us to examine our motives and our interests constantly and suggests that both our individual and collective judgments are at once legitimate and highly fallible. The historical record supports such a view. After all, if there was one impulse shared by all the founders, it was a rejection of all forms of absolute authority, whether the king, the theocrat, the general, the oligarch, the dictator, the majority, or anyone else who claims to make choices for us. But it's not just absolute power that the founders sought to guard against. Implicit in its structure, in the very idea of ordered liberty, was a rejection of absolute truth, the infallibility of any idea or ideology or theology or ism, any tyrannical consistency that might lock future generations into a single, unalterable course, or drive both majorities and minorities into the cruelties of the Inquisition, the pogrom, the gulag, or the jihad. The founders may have trusted in God, but true to the Enlightenment spirit, they also trusted in the minds and senses that God had given them. They were suspicious of abstraction and liked asking questions, which is why, at every turn in our early history, theory yielded to fact and necessity. A rejection of absolutism in all its forms may sometimes slip into moral relativism or even nihilism, an erosion of values that hold society together. But for most of our history, it has encouraged the very process of information gathering, analysis, argument, and persuasion that allows us to make better, if not perfect, choices, not only about the means to our ends, but also the ends themselves. The constitutional framework has allowed us to continually test out our ideals, our vision, and our values against the realities of a common life, ensuring that they're poked, prodded, and sifted through, so that over time they may be refined or discarded or replaced by new ideals, sharper visions, deeper values. Indeed, it is that process, according to Madison, that brought about the Constitution itself, a convention in which no man felt himself obliged to retain his opinions any longer than he was satisfied of their propriety and truth, and was open to the force of argument. In sum, the Constitution envisions a roadmap by which we marry passion to reason, the ideal of individual freedom to the demands of community. And the amazing thing is that it's worked. Through the early days of the Union, through depressions and World War, through the multiple transformations of the economy and Western expansion, and the arrival of millions of immigrants to our shores, our democracy has not only survived, but has thrived. Only once has the conversation broken down, and that was over the one subject the founders refused to talk about. The Declaration of Independence may have been, in the words of historian Joseph Ellis, a transformative moment in world history, when all laws and human relationships dependent on coercion would be swept away forever. But that spirit of liberty did not extend, in the minds of the founders, to the slaves that worked their fields, made their beds, and nursed their children. The Constitution's exquisite machinery would secure the rights of citizens, those deemed members of America's political community, but it provided no protection to those outside the constitutional circle, the Native Americans whose treaties proved worthless before the court of the conqueror, or the black man, Dred Scott, who would walk into the Supreme Court a free man and leave a slave. Democratic deliberation might have been sufficient to expand the franchise to white men without property, and eventually women. Reason and argument and American pragmatism might have eased the economic growing pains of a great nation and helped lessen religious and class tensions that would plague other nations. But deliberation alone could not provide the slave his freedom or cleanse America of its original sin. In the end, it was the sword that would sever his chains. What does this say about our democracy? There's a school of thought that sees the Founding Fathers only as hypocrites, and the Constitution only as a betrayal of the grand ideals set forth by the Declaration of Independence, that agrees with early abolitionists that the Great Compromise between North and South was a pact with the devil. Others, representing the safer, more conventional wisdom, will insist that all the constitutional compromise on slavery were necessary, if unfortunate requirements, for the formation of the Union, that in their silence the founders only sought to postpone what they were certain would be slavery's ultimate demise, that this single lapse cannot detract from the genius of the Constitution, which permitted the space for abolitionists to rally and the debate to proceed, and that provided the framework by which, after the Civil War had been fought, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments could be passed and the Union finally perfected. How can I, an American with the blood of Africa coursing through my veins, choose sides in such a dispute? I can't. I love America too much, am too invested in what this country has become, too committed to its institutions, its beauty, and even its ugliness, to focus entirely on the circumstances of its birth. But neither can I brush aside the magnitude of the injustice done, or erase the ghosts of generations past, or ignore the open wound, the aching spirit, which ails this country still. I'm left then with Lincoln, who, like no man before or since, understood both the deliberative function of our democracy and the limits of such deliberation. We remember him for the firmness and depth of his convictions, his unyielding opposition to slavery, and his determination that a house divided could not stand. But his presidency was guided by a practicality that would distress us today, a practicality that led him to test various bargains with the South in order to maintain the Union without war, to appoint and discard general after general, strategy after strategy, once war broke out, to stretch the Constitution to the breaking point in order to see the war through to a successful conclusion. I like to believe that for Lincoln it was never a matter of abandoning conviction for the sake of expediency. Rather, it was a matter of maintaining within himself the balance between two contradictory ideas, that we must talk and reach for common understandings precisely because all of us are imperfect and can never act with the certainty that God is on our side. And yet at times we must act nonetheless, as if we are certain, protected from error only by providence. The blood of slaves reminds us that our pragmatism can sometimes be moral cowardice. Lincoln, and those buried at Gettysburg, remind us that we should only pursue our own absolute truths if we accept that there may be a terrible price to pay. Such late-night meditations proved unnecessary in my immediate decision about George W. Bush's nominees to the Federal Court of Appeals. In the end, the crisis in the Senate was averted, or at least postponed. 7 Democratic senators agreed not to filibuster all but 2 of Bush's most controversial nominees, and to preserve their support of a filibuster only in more extraordinary circumstances. In exchange, 7 Republicans agreed to vote against a nuclear option that would permanently eliminate the filibuster, again with the caveat that they could change their minds in the event of extraordinary circumstances. No one was more ecstatic with this turn of events than Senator Byrd. The day the deal was announced, he walked triumphantly down the halls of the Capitol with Republican John Warner of Virginia, the younger members trailing behind the old lions. "We have kept the Republic," Senator Byrd announced to a pack of reporters, and I smiled to myself, thinking back to the visit that the two of us had finally been able to arrange a few months earlier. It was in Senator Byrd's hideaway on the first floor of the Capitol, tucked alongside a series of small, beautifully painted rooms, where Senate committees once regularly met. His secretary had led me into his private office, which was filled with books and what looked to be aging manuscripts, the walls lined with old photographs and campaign memorabilia. Senator Byrd asked me if it would be all right if we took a few photographs together, and we shook hands and smiled for the photographer who was present. After the secretary and the photographer had left, we sat down in a pair of well-worn chairs. Eventually, I asked him what advice he would give me as a new member of the Senate. "Learn the rules," he said, nodding to himself. not just the rules, but the precedents as well. He pointed to a series of thick binders behind him, each one affixed with a handwritten label. Not many people bother to learn them these days. Everything is so rushed, so many demands on a senator's time. But these rules unlock the power of the Senate. They're the keys to the kingdom. We spoke about the Senate's past, the presidents he had known, the bills he had managed. He told me I would do well in the Senate, but I shouldn't be in too much of a rush. So many senators today became fixated on the White House, not understanding that in the constitutional design, it was the Senate that was supreme, the heart and soul of the Republic. So few people read the Constitution today, Senator Byrd said, pulling out his copy from his breast pocket. I've always said this document and the Holy Bible, they've been all the guidance I need. Before I left, he insisted that his secretary bring in a set of his Senate histories for me to have. As he slowly set the beautifully bound books on the table and searched for a pen, I told him how remarkable it was he had found the time to write. Oh, I've been very fortunate, he said, nodding to himself. Much to be thankful for. There's not much I would do over. Suddenly he paused and looked squarely into my eyes. I have only one regret, you know. The foolishness of youth. We sat there for a moment, considering the gap of years and experience between us. We all have regrets, Senator, I said finally. We just ask that in the end, God's grace shines upon us. He studied my face for a moment, then nodded with the slightest of smiles and flipped open the cover of one of the books. God's grace. Yes, indeed. Let me sign these for you then, he said. And taking one hand to steady the other, he slowly scratched his name on the gift.